opinions expressed on this podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the views or endorsement of any entity. Nothing being said on this podcast should be considered as investment advice.
All right, GM, welcome to 100 Proof Live. I'm Kevin Rose.
I'm Derek Edwards.
This is the show where we cover all things NFTs, which is, if you're new to the show, non-fungible tokens, which are not fungible. And we have a great show today. Like, what's one more thing to explain?
We're 18 months into the biggest bear ever. If you're just learning about NFTs, you just showed up today.
Yeah. There's some people that are out there. I guarantee there's one person that's like, what the fuck am I watching right now?
Okay. You're probably right.
Derek Kleib Kronersee, obviously.
Hello.
Great to have you here. Sam Proof's director of research, alive and well. He was supposed to be here today. Some bad weather got to him. What happened, Sam?
There was like a blizzard out here, blizzard in the mountains of Colorado, and they canceled all flights afternoon. So couldn't make it, going to go to this wedding tomorrow. So I'll be in LA tomorrow, but decided to stay here today and crank some stuff out and then miss the rehearsal dinner. But I'll be in LA tomorrow. But yeah, that sucks.
Well, it is beautiful out here, so you won't need a lot of blizzard gear.
He's layered up right now.
He's layered up.
The blizzard is in the house.
Oh, we got to talk about gear today too, but we're going to talk about Amanda first. Amanda's here.
Hi, Amanda.
Hi, how's Bruce, it going?
Head of culture and community.
Let's go.
AKA Stevie, the one and only.
I'm sorry, Sam. That's a very Friday the 13th thing to happen to you, to get blizzard out. But we'll see you. I guess we weren't going to see you. I'm sorry. Sucks that you're not here.
Hi, everyone. It's Friday the 13th. I didn't even know that.
It's Friday the 13th.
Didn't realize it either.
Now I'm kind of freaked
Spooky
out.
Spooky season, baby.
Yeah.
All right. Let's do a little check-in on the shoe game. You guys were giving me shit when I got here.
I think you win again.
I texted you. I said, bring some crazy shoes.
I was running out of the house. So I was like, I can't do it today.
All right. These are Avism, which is a Japanese brand. They are...
Not the cult.
What was the cult?
Do you remember that Hollywood cult, Vivism, whatever?
No.
Never mind.
I'm not a member of any cult. But I am a huge fan of Japanese sneakers, and these are some kind of funky looking ones. But I do have on a hat, though, by the way. Oh, there they are. Look at those beauties.
Those look sweet.
I actually get more hate about these than any other shoe I own.
You have this affinity for Japanese streetwear.
I do. I love a good Japanese streetwear kind of stuff. Cool. This hat is a crazy hat because this is actually, you can take a look at this one here. This is a hat that we had made right after Moonbird's launch. They goofed up. They did a blacked out Moonbird and you can barely see it. And half the stitching is broken. So we actually have like 30 of these prototypes. So this is a very early Moonbird
hat.
They're
pretty sweet.
And then, I added the crummy squiggles to the jacket. We got a lot of stuff going on here. So I'm fully NFT decked out today.
I've actually been eyeing my mintage jacket, the one that we got on the pod the other night. And I want to add more patches to it.
Dude, we got to add more patches.
It's looking cool. We'll figure out something.
Will you do a Kleib Kronersee patch? Because that would be fun. We should do that.
I'm putting it in the file cabinet now. Zach... We're going to do patches. We'll talk. We'll sync later.
Love it. All right. So, So later on in today's show, we have a special guest who is artist and designer Peter Saville, who is most known for the album cover for Joy Division, Unknown Pleasures. Joy Division's Unknown Pleasures is such an iconic. You'll know it when you see it. Everybody knows this cover. This is like... Ooh. I've seen it on more t-shirts over the last couple decades.
There it is.
Ooh. I mean, it is one of the most badass designs that I've always been a huge fan of. And it is just an honor to have him on the show today. We're doing a collaboration with Pace called CP1919, which is available now. If you're watching live, it closes today. So this is going to be a great interview. And what an honor to have him on as a guest.
It's awesome. It's going to be a fun one.
All right. How's Amanda? Do you want to check with the audience? What's going on over there?
Yes. Shout out to Mine Rash. I see a lot of people, first of all, a lot of people really want that blacked out Moonbird hat. People are asking to raffle it off.
I think we have a
couple of them, so you might be able to actually make that happen. And I think that's
100%.
You were kind of teasing it, but I'm like, let's make that happen, right? Let's do it. and then Mine Rash with the shorts reference.
She loves
to see you in the shorts. We all love the shorts.
We'll do like a little audience poll later, but like, not sure these are the optimal camera angles for wearing shorts on the show. We'll work on that.
We literally, before the show went live, we were like, yeah, there's a lot of crotch shots that are happening on this show. We're just like trying to figure out the right angles here. I'm doing the cross here for the protection.
Nice.
But for now, apologies and you're welcome.
We're just trying to give Derek his, what's the name of the founder of Ethereum?
Vitalik?
His Vitalik moment right now. But that's all. We're just trying to get him memed out. Okay, but I just want to shout out Ariel. Ariel from Pace. I'm sorry, Ariel, that you're here and watching us just be a little silly. But it's nice to see you in the comments. It's nice to see Justin here. I see Forrest, our team members. I see Artist Milk. Shout out to all of you guys who are here in the audience. Keep it going with some good comments because I'm gonna be shouting them out throughout the show. Let's go.
Yes. And then also Proof is going to be continuing Peter's tribute later this month, which is called Notes from a Neutron Star. And that drop is, it's going to be out in the fall winter series of drops, which is really exciting as well.
Yeah, Notes from a Neutron Star is our sort of homage to Peter Saville and the CP1919 project. It will be minting begins October 26th. We are super excited about that. And then just a little like kind of recap. I know we said we were going to have a little artist spotlight at the end of the show, but for folks who don't know, CP1919 is, again, this iconic sort of take on that very iconic album cover. And then Notes from a Neutron Star is sort of Proof's homage to that. We are going to have artists Aaron Penne, Jesse Woolston, and Luke Shannon all have their own sort of reinterpretation of that iconic album. So stay tuned for all of that. You can check it all out on our Proof Twitter and on our website very soon. So really exciting.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's going to be awesome. All right. So Sam, excited to check in with you and get a market update. I know we're not doing those as frequently these days, so it's always nice to have you on Friday to kind of give us an overview of what's been going on throughout the week. What's the hot news? What's the market doing in terms of, you know, all things NFTs? So yeah, what's the latest?
For sure. And one thing to throw in is that we are going to start kind of, we call it the daily. I need a new term, but doing Mondays and Wednesdays, and that's going to, we're going to be doing, bringing back the show Monday, Wednesday. It's going to go into the Proof Discord. So you have to be a Moonbirds holder to get that access, but that is something just to look forward to starting on Monday. And then, so Monday, Wednesday, we'll be doing the used to be daily show, and then Friday, 100 Proof. As far as just a quick update on where the market has been this past week, I think when you look at this volume chart, you know, it's pretty much kind of where we've been, you know, just been kind of drudging along for the past month or two at pretty low levels. Then if you jump over to what the PFPs have been doing, you know, it's kind of similar. You know, I think the big downtrend in PFPs has taken a break of sorts. We've been pretty flat for the past 2 weeks. So that's certainly better than the downtrend we've seen. And then if you look over at Artblocks, again, I talked about this last week, you know, Artblocks had a huge up move after that first Sotheby's auction with the portfolio for 3Arrow Capital. And then kind of since then, it's just kind of, you know, the floor prices have grinded a little bit lower. So that's kind of where we are right now. There is actually a deer with big antlers outside my window right now. That's a separate point.
Shut up.
You should be looking at the left, like, wow, there's a deer there. But that's beside the point. Let's talk about art sales. There are a bunch of interesting art sales. I think in the top left here, this looks like collection sales, so not really one of ones. But other than that, you had a ringer, which sold for 21 WEETH. There are actually two ringers that sold for 21. Cool ringer is certainly below the price we've been seeing. You know, the floor is around 30, so 21 is a bit of a step down, but there were two sales at that price. I think the Winds of Yawanawa, obviously just hugely in focus right now, as everything Rafiki Anadol is in focus right now. They revealed this week, and there was one really kind of outlier sale, which sold for 20 ETH, which you can see there in the upper right. I also wanted to throw in this Opepin in the lower left. You know, it's from, I believe, the fourth or fifth series. This isn't from the original series, but it really kind of is a hat tip to alien CryptoPunks, and it sold for 30 ETH. That's the third highest Opepin sale ever. And then there's a Subscape here by Matt Delaurier for 12 ETH. Beautiful. Just a really just kind of, yeah, it's an incredible palette, incredible style there, selling for 12, which is about four times the floor. But I think when you see that piece, you can understand why. Just to jump into one of one art sales, again, you know, we haven't seen a whole lot of one of one sales above 10 ETH, you know, in the past couple of weeks. There's one which I put here in the lower left, which is a piece called Elon, God of Memes, by Alpha Centauri Kid for 20 ETH. Kind of interesting story. This is the first piece of art that Alpha Centauri Kid ever put on chain. 3 years ago, and he sent it to a wallet that he thought was Elon's. Turns out that wasn't Elon's wallet, but whoever did get it ended up selling it for 3 ETH.
Oh, wow.
And then it resold this week for 20 ETH. You know, so kind of cool piece of history. He says this was like when I was still in experiment mode. It was called the pre-ACK wallet. So clearly a very different look, but awesome to see that sale for him. And then a couple other pieces. This piece, Dave, by Osanachi for 7.2 ETH. The Detective by Harley Davidson for 6.2. This is a really like a murder mystery in an NFT, which they made in conjunction with or working with Transient Labs. And then The Alchemist by Fo for 4.5 ETH. So some cool sales this week. Couple other things just to touch on. Here's the chart for Winds of Yawanawa. Obviously, you know, Rafiq has been hugely in the news, partially because there were the reveals for Winds of Yawanawa. But then secondly, the piece Unsupervised Machine Hallucinations was donated by Ryan Zur to the MoMA permanent collection. And that obviously, you know, something that I think we're going to talk about. But when that happened at the reveals, you saw a little bit of a price fall, as often happens on reveals. Then this MoMA taking this piece came into the news and prices rose again. Last art thing I want to talk about, Gabe Weist. You know, he's been a friend of Proof, been to a few of our events. He's done the Stoics,
awesome,
and a bunch of other things. He created this set called The Blame Game, where he made 55 different NFT or different 55 different images where he basically was throwing blame for all problems at various people in the ecosystem. Here on the right, you can see Snowfro stole the rainbow. On the left, Xcopy took all the ETH, and all I got was the ability to copy his work. Definitely worth checking these out because they're awesome. 55 of them, and it sold out in 2 minutes, raised $18,000, did that through Nifty Gateway. So kind of cool to see interesting stuff sell out even in this market. And then lastly, the Blur, you know, Blur had two announcements. One was from Blur, where they announced that season two is going to end on November 20th. So in about a month and a week, you know, it's been a hot topic, you know, for many weeks. So nice to get some clarity there. And then the Blur Foundation, this wasn't actually from Blur, it's from someone who owned Blur Token, put out a proposal that Blur start to charge a 1% fee, which includes different fee discounts for people who own a lot of Blur, basically just trying to get a little bit more utility in the Blur Token outside of the governance aspect. Because with just the governance, we've seen the price go down a fair bit. So that's all from me. A lot of stuff to talk about, but yeah, that's it.
It's funny, Sam, when I look at when I look at just what's going on in the ecosystem in general, you know, you see, I was telling you this earlier, you know, I like to use external sources of news that are outside of our bubble, so I can just get a perspective of what the normies think of the crypto space in general. And, sure, you know, for me, I was reading a bunch of articles on the FT, the Financial Times, because, you know, international publication. And they were covering the FTX trial and everything. And there was this opinion piece about how crypto is filled with scams. And there's all this other thing. And then I look at what Sam just dropped with all that beautiful art and everything that's going on there. And Rafiq entering the permanent collection at the MoMA. And you're just like, wow, there are two very different narratives going on right now.
Totally.
One of them is like crypto that's just like Mike Tyson's in the ring, just giving you body blow after body blow of random shit. And then there's like legitimate, amazing collectible art that's happening that I think is durable, that's here to stay, that I'm excited for. I was looking at those pieces and I'm like, I want that Snowfall Stole the Rainbow.
That's cool.
Like, that's so cool.
It's very cool.
Like, how do we reconcile this?
It's crazy. No, I was just talking to, I think it was Carly Riley. I was talking to somebody recently about this where, the incentives of just traditional media to report on what's happening in this space are just off. Like, their audience doesn't understand it.
Yeah.
They have to like get an article out with that day or later that week. So the depth that they can go to like report on news like this is, you know, often very surface level for those that are spending all of their time thinking about it. And these things just have a way of, like, you know, capturing a narrative that isn't just like what we see every day.
Yeah. And in our space, the immediate thing that's happening right now, at least just confined to NFTs, is Blur Season 2. You know, I'm curious, what is your guys' take on Blur Season 2? This announcement that came out, you know, November 20th. What is this going to do to the ecosystem? Like, what's your take?
Yeah, I mean, Sam has been reporting on these seasons since the very beginning. So I think, you know, Sam, why don't you weigh in? You're about as close to this and reporting on this about as anyone in the space. Do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of different aspects to it. First of all, I think it was important that they at least draw a line in the sand and say when season two is going to end. Because for background, a lot of people have been farming Blur token, and right now all they have is points, and those points convert into the Blur token at an unknown date, and that date was unknown. So they really needed to just kind of give clarity so people could build their models around how much risk they wanted to put on in exchange for these points and ultimately figure out what their points are going to be worth. I think that, you know, so I think it's good that they provided some clarity there. You know, we've seen over the past month or two as the token has gone down that, you know, I used to be in a lot of discords with various like Blur token farmers, and those have totally shifted to talking about Frentech or farming other things. So I think the mass movement towards Blur token farming, kind of ended a little while ago. So I don't think, I think some of this is as far as the impact on the overall market, I think that a lot of it has already gone away. My view, I've been outspoken about this. I personally think that, you know, what season two has really been filled with is incentivizing people to bid on NFTs, create liquidity that way. I think that it's surprisingly turned out to be a real negative for prices for reasons we can go into. I think it's one of the more interesting economic things we've gotten to watch, how paying people to bid on NFTs that they ultimately don't want has led, you know, I think has been quite a negative for prices, along with other things that have been negative for prices. So I think ending that will be good. And then the only thing I'll say on top of that is we don't know what season three is going to bring. I have heard kind of different type of ways to short NFTs could be possible, different ways to go long in different ways could be possible. I think there will be some new kind of tech innovation, NFTFi innovation that's going to be coming. So I think it is very hard to know the impact until we know what season three is going to bring.
One quick last question there. How many Blur, at the end of this season, do we have any sense of how many total tokens are going to be available? And will farmers get those all at once? Meaning, do we have a potential of just everyone dumping into the market and crashing the Blur token?
We don't. I mean, they've been pretty clear that it's going to be 300 million tokens or more. So he said on a Spaces once there could be more than 300 million, but 300 million is the amount that we should count on going. And I believe it's going to be all at once. You could see a lot of dumping. I mean, but at the same time, this is a well-known date where, 300 million token are going to become available. So who knows how the market's going to react? But yes, it is a lot of supply that has potential to flood the market. You know, today's been a pretty busy day for the Blur token because of the proposal, and it's done about $25 million of volume. So 300 million, you know, it's about $40 million, $45 million of volume. So, you know, it is substantial. And it'll be new supply in the market.
The only thing I would add, and we didn't get a chance to really talk about this, but there was a community proposal this week from a community holder of the token who proposed the ability for the protocol for Blur for exchanging and facilitating a trade between a buyer and a seller, for there to be a 1%, you know, rent seeking fee that goes back to buying and burning the token, or another mechanism by which that, you know, 1% could flow back to token holders. And I think what we haven't seen to date is any articulation from the community or stakeholders or the team on how a token can be used. It's really been meant to be used as an incentive directive to engage with the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And I think this was the first proposal by a community member that said, here's how this thing could actually accrete value in the future. And so, you know, who knows if this improvement proposal will get legs or people will talk about it. But I think what it does do is start to paint a picture where this token actually may have some productive use in the future if the community wants it, which may counteract some of the effects of all of these tokens starting to enter, you know, circulating supply. I don't have a strong opinion one way or the other. I'm more just articulating these conversations have a way of kind of playing with the rest of the news.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah, well, I put in a I'm sorry. I was just, the foundation tweeted out that I retweeted that. So you can check my Twitter and you can see that proposal. And there's a lot of dialogue in there, and it is interesting. I think, you know, for a governance token, there haven't really been any proposals for 8 months, you know. So I think that this holder was basically saying, guys, if we want this token to be a governance token, there has to be a bit more activity here. And then obviously, I think the big question is always should fees come in and how, you know, because to Derek's point, one would think that with so much supply coming out, perhaps, you know, you'd have some sort of initiative to offset that. Although this was from the community as opposed to Blur itself.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks, Sam, for your insights there. I know you track this really closely. Great. Let's get to some community questions. Amanda.
Some people are like, are we still even doing Blur? Alex Gardner said, Blur farmers no more. You know, I think obviously there are some people like Sam that are really kind of watching the market. But I do think that as somebody says, Mindrash is like, is Frentech still a thing? Because it seems like a lot of people have kind of moved on over there. I think it's really interesting from my point of view. Some of the comments that I saw on that tweet was, number one, I think the person who actually put up that proposal was a VC and might be invested in Blur. So it makes sense that they'd want to kind of do that. But, you know, in a governance token, anyone can put up a proposal. So good for them.
Yeah.
And then the fact that it is now all of a sudden, you know, Blur is no longer the zero fee marketplace. If this passes, you know, does that sort of kind of take away from the selling point of Blur in the first place? But let's say it passes. Let's say they start throwing some, you know, shorting tech or some crazy NFT-fi stuff in there. Maybe people will think that 1% fee is worth it. So it will be interesting to see. They're clearly just trying to kind of stay alive, and let's see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. It's worth tracking.
Yeah.
But on to and back to Art.
Yes.
Rafiq, who, of course, we love. Previous Grails artist. And I was going to ask you, man, if you can look up Rafiq's Grail, if you wouldn't mind. I don't have a computer in front of me.
Sure.
And just see what it's trading at. I'm really curious because that's a good way to get one of Rafiq's pieces.
The last time I checked, nothing was on sale.
They were all sold out.
Nothing was listed, basically. Yeah. Last time I checked, but I'll check again.
Cool. So, you know, Rafiq has a piece going into MoMA's permanent collection. It's
pretty awesome.
Doesn't surprise me, though.
Why doesn't it surprise you?
Just because he's so prolific now, and you just see him everywhere. I see him at LAX, I see him in the Sphere in Vegas. You know, he's got, you know, great collaborations that he's done in the past. He's just known as his work is so visually stunning that it doesn't surprise me that this is going to be one of the blue chip NFT artists that emerges. And
yeah,
clearly that's the case now.
Yeah. And it comes at a time where, like, we're at a fever pitch for how AI is going to change the world. And it just so happens that we've had an AI artist who's been making work for the better part of a decade and, you know, building and ossifying a community based around his work, the storytelling that he's done, the collaborations that he's done, the partnerships that he's done. It feels like he is just, you know, has become this person who this character around this advent of this new technology in many ways from a creative perspective. And so it's awesome to see it. It's I know you guys have partnered with him on Grails. I know he's doing stuff with Sphere right now.
Oh, there's our Grail right there. Look how beautiful that one is.
I refuse to tell you what the floor price is because it is criminal and I want it. So
are you serious?
I won't tell you.
It's going to be, it's too late. The fact that you just said that,
it's
people
gone
in Discord are going to go, what's the floor on it right now?
Fuck. Sorry. 1.76.
Oh, yeah. That's going to be picked up in 2 seconds.
What are you doing, guy? It's fine. It's cool.
Is it just one listed? Is there more listed?
1.76, 5 ETH. 14.49.
Okay.
You know what will end up happening? Like, and I'm not going to, you know, this is not a articulation on like, should people be buying NFTs right now or not? It's more just like a thought. I think some of, you know, what's the difficulty in discovering that this was a Grails piece that Rafiq did is lending. I mean, like there is asymmetry everywhere still in this
piece.
There isn't like a place where you can go to see all of Rafiq's previous work on chain and like see, you know, what the relative comps against each other, or see the addition or the supply size or whatever it may be, or like the most recently traded from this collection versus that collection.
That's a great point.
And I think over time, those arbs are going to close.
Yes.
Right? Like we're just going to get so much better at display and discovery and being able to parse out rich information on chain into a way that's digestible and stuff like that,
yeah,
you know, will just like close itself pretty quickly.
One thing I was going to tell everyone out there, you know, I had the pleasure of touring Rafiq's studio over in Frogtown out here in LA.
Yeah.
Talk about just an amazing place, mm-hmm. filled with robots doing pin work, you know, massive displays all over the place, a bunch of AI stuff that he was showing me that really early on. And he is the nicest human, number one, which is he's like a Snowfro type character where you're just like, how can you not love this guy?
Yeah.
And he said to me, and this was a few months ago, let's put it at 90% chance of it happening. But he said, if you want to do a Proof of Moonbirds meetup exclusively for your members, and you know, so that they can come out and actually hang out at the studio and get a personal walkthrough from him, he was game. So I'm going to work on making that happen, and we'll get that date set up sometime in the future.
There's also a couple of amazing restaurants out there on that side of town, so you guys should do something there. I'll pop over and we should all go eat somewhere cool.
More East Side stuff.
Yeah. You have a Moonbird?
I have multiple Moonbirds.
Okay, then you're allowed. Yeah. Then you're in.
All right, I got a quick question here.
Yeah, sure.
If it's all right, I just got a quick question kind of on this topic. You know, I think when I think of this year, it's been a bear market for sure. But one positive kind of recurring theme has been museums taking up NFTs.
Yes.
You know, I mean, with the CryptoPunks, both in Europe as well as the U.S. and elsewhere, you know, Beeple sales, you know, in China. I feel like museums and institutions taking on NFTs has been a big theme.
Christie's.
The other thing is that... You know, is that, yeah, oh, I mean, Christie's and Sotheby's have, you seem to have NFTs as a top priority. You know, the other thing is that MoMA has been displaying Rafiq's work for a very long time, maybe not very long time, but for a while, you know, and it's, I think that's quite iconic already. So what do you guys think is the incremental thing of them having a wallet where they own NFTs? Where do you think this moves the needle? Because it's obviously good and exciting news, but where do you specifically think this moves the needle?
I mean, for me, and then I'll let Derek and Amanda chime in here. For me, it's just another amazing feather in the cap, and to say like, hey, they're taking this seriously. Yeah. Like, you don't move something to the permanent collection unless you believe there's actually some permanence to it.
There's a process.
There's a whole process to it.
People debating.
Exactly. And so that to me is just a big win for the entire NFT ecosystem to think that more NFTs can make it into the permanent collection.
Yeah. I'll add one thought, which is, you know, this is the first blockchain-based digital artwork that MoMA has put into their permanent collection. If you think that this playbook isn't going to get run hundreds of times again over the next decade, you're crazy. Like, this is, they're not going to stop with Rafiq. Right. They're not going to stop with this one object. And this is where, you know, like the inevitability of this space is just so obvious at this point. You have the largest exhibitions right now around digital are happening with some of these contemporary institutions. You have museums like LACMA and MoMA taking these things into their permanent collection. You have amazing work that continues to persist, and people are storing value in them and collecting them. And, you know, these collector bases are coming around very specific artists that just, and, you know, Wins is just continuing to do well on the heels of this. I mean, there's just so much energy and electricity around this space that just feels inevitable.
Oh, man.
It's just...
We need bedtime stories with Derek where I just, where I'm about to go to sleep at night and I'm worried and I put my headphones in and it's like, NFTs are going to be just fine, Kevin. Just relax.
They really will.
Take a deep breath.
It's like, it's programmed, guys. Yeah. So like, the writing is on the wall. It's like the genie's out of the bottle. It's on this time frame, on this timeline, it's inevitable.
Love
I just want to thank Derek for always giving me the script so that I have something ready for, you know, Thanksgiving and Christmas with my family. Exactly. You know, what are you doing over there again with the NFTs? Listen, Derek says, trust minimized ledgers,
you
know, digital objects, let's go, you know?
It's the best.
Culture, all of that.
All right. So let's speaking of NFTs and them entering other worlds, we had a really cool tweet from Tyler Hobbs saying, yes, generative art tattoos are here. And there is to many people, this was a new startup because they just came out of stealth, but they've been around for multiple years figuring out how they can do machine-based tattoos, non-human, meaning like a machine hovers over a body part and then does these really small, micro, high precision tattoos that would be much harder to do with hand, with by hand. And so what I mean by that is I jumped on a call with Tyler last night, and he described to me that this machine has these sensors that can measure like the dermis layer of the skin, know exactly the depth that they have to penetrate to get the precision of the ink staying and holding. It's actually a lot less painful because you don't have to go as deep. Mm. And you get a higher fidelity, higher resolution tattoo that in theory lasts longer and doesn't have as much degradation as a traditional tattoo, all done with this machine. And so this is kind of awesome because it's an idea that you would be able to use an algorithm, apply it to something, and then have the machine do a generative one-of-one tattoo for you. Which is a really, really fun idea.
And if you ever want to sell it, you just cut off that limb, tokenize it, put it in a vault, have a token trading
stretch
around it.
The skin around, yeah.
Real world assets to the next level. Let's go.
No, this is awesome. I love stuff like this. So there was a project by Scott Campbell, who's based out here in Los Angeles, called Scapshot. I'm a huge Scott Campbell fan. He actually gave me this tattoo.
Nice.
No way. That's a Scott Campbell.
This is a Scott Campbell original. And he had an on-chain tattoo project at one point. I think they've taken a bit of a pause, but this idea of being able to marry everything that we love about procedure and randomness and on-chain art with, you know, like these physical manifestations, in this case, a tattoo, it just feels like this is where we're going. This
Scott office. Scott had I've known Scott for a few years now, and he had a really cool thing called Glory Hole. Do you know about Glory Hole? It was where you would stick your limb through like a piece of like wood where you couldn't see on the other side, and then he would tattoo whatever he wanted on you.
It was like, it was an example of generative art,
right?
And this was back, I think, in like the late 90s, early 2000s.
And he had a line of people waiting for a random tattoo. They had no idea what they were going to get until they pulled their arm out or leg out or whatever it may be. Really cool idea. So I spoke with Tyler. He's super excited about this project. He has an algorithm that he can apply specifically to birds, which is in some of the videos here. And he asked me if I wanted to be one of the three people that's going to get this tattoo. And awesome. I said, yes. And so I'm going to actually get one of three. Tyler, he's going to do three in total. Tyler Hobbs. And what he does, and he said the process will look like this. I'll fly out to Austin. He'll sit down with me for a day. He'll work on that original bird design with you for an entire day. And then he'll apply his generative algorithm to it to make it kind of change in a unique way.
Awesome.
And so for me, I already have a hummingbird on my chest because it was my dad's favorite bird when he passed away. And I got that as a symbol to him. One of our grills artists, Jess Machete, who's amazing. She did the work. The bird I want to get, I think it's a crane, you know, the crane birds. Mm-hmm. And in the movie Kubo was a fantastic film, by the way. In the movie Kubo, oh my God, you got to watch it.
Right.
In the movie Kubo, they talk about how cranes in Japanese culture were used to symbolize the caring of a spirit after death to the afterworld. Mm. And so he's going to do a crane for me, and then have something that you can see there's a part of his algorithm, how it kind of pixelates it and deteriorates it over multiple images. I'm going to go sit in front of the machine, lay down, we'll film it, we'll have fun with it. And he's also going to give me a print of it as well, not an NFT, but a print of it that I can have framed and put up that my kids can have that and always say, like, this is a tattoo that Dad got by Tyler.
It's amazing.
And so it seems expensive when you look at the design fee, $8,000, all that, but you're getting like multiple days of Tyler's time dedicated to you to work through this process with you. So I'm just honored that he would think
this
of me
looks,
to do
I
this.
I mean, to get that Tyler for a day doing design work for you, like, this is actually kind of cheap. It looks like the majority of that fee is really, you know, Tyler's opportunity costs and pricing that, and which is totally reasonable. I mean, frankly, it looks like a steal.
I know you won't want to.
I do. I'm throwing in my hat in the ring.
Tyler, we sold you out just like that.
Dog,
just,
sorry.
Just proof members alone. But obviously Tyler is such a good human. Love that guy, and always pushing the boundaries in new and exciting ways. So what a fun thing.
Cool.
I have a question from the audience.
Yeah, shoot.
Mind Rash, you're making me saying it. Mind Rash wants to know if Tyler Hobbs also has a glory hole.
He does not. He is not doing. It is my understanding that he is not doing random generative tattoos just yet. So he is doing, these are all designed with Tyler himself.
Yes.
So, but I mentioned that on the, in the conversation where, all jokes aside about the glory hole, that the idea of sitting down and not knowing what you're going to get via Tyler would be crazy.
Totally.
That would be fun. Can you imagine just sitting down and being like, okay, I don't know what algorithm he's going to choose, and it just does something on It'd your arm? Awesome. It'd be really, really, really awesome.
I also love that like artists have been playing with these ideas of chance and procedure for a long time, and we now have the technology to automate it. It's just the best.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
Very cool. All right. I think that is it for that story. Amanda, any other questions from the audience, or was that pretty much it?
No, I think everyone's super excited. And everyone's very, very jealous. I think they think it's a really great idea. Marcella says, it's Kubo and the Two Strings is the name of that movie, right?
Oh, so good. 100%.
Yeah, but that's it. I think it's super exciting. So,
and I will say, if you have not seen that film, please, please, please add it to your list this weekend. It is beautiful. Stop motion animation. Ooh. It's more of an adult film. Not adult, but for older people. All right. With that, I'm going to kick things over to Sam to let Sam take it away from here and bring some structure to this conversation. Sam, how you doing?
It's because CT's not here.
Bring CT structure, can't so much. Not yet. We're good. It's been a fun conversation.
Yeah. So Sam, over to you. And we have obviously Peter waiting here to chat about his project, which we're super excited to hear about.
Peter, thank you so much for hopping on this call with us. We really appreciate it.
It's actually been very entertaining and very informative for me. I'm kind of enjoying it. I might come back next week.
Let's go.
Well, if you want to come back, we'd love to keep talking to you. But what has
Sam? I'm happy just listening. It's like it's interesting just to listen to.
I'm kind of curious for someone kind of with your art and design background, kind of speaking to your insinuation there. What's been your experience with the NFT space and with just as someone who's kind of an observer and new and entering it? How's that been for you?
Well, I mean, I don't know how long it is now, 2 years, 3 years. It's been a roller coaster for me. There were really amazing, positive feelings that I had about it at the beginning because all the work that I've been involved in for, let's say, since the early 90s, so let's say 30 years minimum, has effectively been digital. I mean, everything's been digital since like 1990. And because I am involved in editions and prints and work in kind of sometimes in limited dimensions, the problem of how you kind of contain the digital file, how you authenticated an original, or how you designated an edition, was always impossible until the advent of the token. So when I heard about it at the beginning, it was like wonderful. I mean, it was incredible and like, you know, decades overdue. So in that sense, it was great. I didn't understand the link to cryptocurrencies from a way of actually understanding. And I'm shy about things that I don't actually understand. I think it did kind of bug me a bit that this essentially crucial technology was intrinsically linked to cryptocurrency, which was always going to be a variable, you know, for some time. And I would say that aspect of it still, you know, troubles me because it kind of, it discredits the understanding of the perception of the value of the token itself. And also the fact that it seems to me that people got interested in buying NFTs, even though they didn't really understand what an NFT was, as opposed to buying work, which had a token to validate it. So it seemed, you know, like 2 years ago that people just, there was like a kind of a, you know, a crazy gold rush of people buying anything that was called an NFT that quite clearly was not going to sustain any value. And then that, yeah. and eventually, it all fell off the cliff. And then everybody is like, has a real downer, you know, as the guys were saying just now, there's like a downer on something which is actually essential in our contemporary culture. So it all has to kind of rebalance.
Yeah, I think that idea, I mean, you have just very different communities that have all come together into this NFT movement. And one of the interesting things, you know, they were talking earlier how every headline that we read is about the demise of NFTs. But in the meantime, you know, the top five or six projects combined to still be worth over $1 billion and do a lot of volume. And I think we're seeing right now that the stuff that has long-term potential is starting to be what really stands out in the space. I'm curious, because what's been the process like to revisit the iconic piece from the Joy Division cover?
Yeah,
that
before we leave this, the generative art,
yeah,
is also obviously fundamentally digital, and it is actually that work which is able to make an addition, a contribution to the canon of art in general, because that generative work could never have occurred in any other way. So you know, as was being discussed earlier, that is the important contribution to the history of art. And of course, it is no surprise to me to see like MoMA believing that they have to take it. And I think it's very honest of MoMA to realize that they need to recognize this work. So that's that. The generative stuff is really quite extraordinary. And I mean, from revisiting, you know, effectively the Joy Division Unknown Pleasures cover, I mean, it has been such a persistent image and such a persistent icon that one way or another, I get to visit it every week, if not every other week, whether it's in the form of another merchandising proposal from somewhere in the world, or just, you know, being out and seeing somebody in the Unknown Pleasures t-shirt, which just seems to be, you know, kind of everywhere around the world. So, you know, and there's sometimes, you know, there's a lot of, it's out there in the public domain with people doing their own version of it, which is kind of fascinating. And sometimes some very amusing versions, which I like.
On top of that, though, with CP1919 and the open edition piece that you're creating, you actually had to come put your own fingerprint on a new version. So you've seen other people put their fingerprints, but here you're really doing something unique and different with your own piece.
So with this new iteration of it, there's always been this reference to the data map diagram as being like a landscape. I mean, it's not a landscape. It's like it's a data map of information, but it's always referred to as a landscape and people talk about it as a landscape. I mean, it even appears in the movie Alien as a landscape. It is a suggestion of the terrain where they respond to the SOS, or the Mayday call. And the image comes up as a kind of proposed landscape. So it's often seen as a landscape. So I actually thought it was interesting to actually turn it into a landscape. So with my colleagues at a studio called Morph in London, we mapped a virtual landscape over the peaks and troughs of the data file. And so kind of creating this kind of very sort of, like a kind of sensual mountain range thing. Now, when looking for how to determine its tonality, because I was seeing it initially as a still image, we started to move the light source around on the virtual model. And as the light source moved, the whole thing kind of came to life in another way. It almost kind of started to breathe. It became quite anthropomorphic in a way. And I was just totally taken by it as a sequence. It's like a motion image sequence. And the effect of the light moving is described as a sweeping sun. So we took this, effect title, Sweeping Sun, as the title for the work. And we created this white version, which is like a polar landscape, as Sweeping Sun White. And then we looked at it in black, like the original Joy Division cover, and that a Sweeping Sun Black. And it was like a kind of palette of graphite in black. It was obviously literally darker, but it had a very different kind of ominous presence. The white one is kind of, like I said, like being on the, you know, like Antarctica somewhere. And the black one is like being inside the world somewhere or on some very dark planet. And as it moved in front of me, I just felt really strongly that it needed an audio. It was movie-like, and it needed an audio. And so I knew who to call. And so I called Stephen Morris, who is, you know, was the percussionist, the drummer in Joy Division, and then in New Order. And Stephen is the keeper of records for Joy Division and New Order. Stephen keeps the data, he keeps the information, he keeps the files, he keeps the tapes, he keeps the codes, Stephen keeps everything. And has also worked on some television and film soundtracks. And I said, Stephen, look at this. Could you write an audio for it? And would you like to do that? And he was really keen. He said, I'd love to. The thing that I didn't know and that was like mind blowing to me when I heard what Stephen had done, he actually had an audio feed from the actual Pulsar. And I said, where did you get that, Stephen? He said, oh, I collect them from different Pulsars. So Stephen, being Stephen, has been collecting this scientific data. So Stephen actually had what you could call the audio feed from this Pulsar, which happens to be a thousand light years away. Now that feed is kind of like static, it's like white noise. In reality, it's like, that's what it is. But Stephen had various software programs where apparently he stretched it out. I mean, and by stretched out, like a second becomes a week. And this white noise turned into initially something that sounded like strings. And stretched out further, it sounded like voices. So this soundtrack is built from the audio feed of not just a pulsar, but the pulsar from which the data came. And then he went into the archive and found one or two bits of Ian Curtis vocal that had never been, you know, kind of released. They were from a live performance. They had audio recordings from live performances, and he found one or two little bits of Ian's vocal from live performances that he felt would blend in with the soundtrack he'd done. And he created this 2-minute audio loop, which really, it quite upset me the first time I heard it. It enhanced the livingness of the image. That thing, like I said earlier, it was like breathing. Well, it became quite like alive when the audio was with it. And when I heard Ian, it was really weird. I mean, he was not singing. It was almost like Ian speaks to you.
Yeah.
So that's kind of quite a weird experience.
One of the things that occurred to me from this is that you built a career around making art for music, but they existed entirely separately. You have albums and then you build art with that. And here you're kind of marrying them together into one actual piece.
Sam, those are both. Yeah, they're both very pertinent statements. Yeah, I did covers about how I felt in the now and about the now, and then they came together with music. And this is, and very differently, this is the first time that I have actually worked like 100% collaboratively with a musician, because basically we have a visual piece and an audio piece, which are one and the same. You know, I made a music video once in the early 80s and learned not to do it again. So this actually, you know, for Stephen and I, you know, we kind of noticed when we were doing it, you know, we both commented on it, that this was actually the first time we'd really done something together. And someone had said to me a few weeks ago, like, is that the new album cover? And I said, well, maybe it is. You know, album covers aren't really needed anymore, except for kind of souvenir hunters and, you know, people who want to buy 12 inches for, you know, kind of vintage purpose or collecting. But from a point of view of any point of view of actually contemporary work, I actually think that this collaboration between visual and sound seems like entirely logical in this medium. I mean, It's like, why would you not do that?
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely. And I think we're seeing all the different ways that people are creating digital art and turning that into NFTs and digital collectibles of sorts. But What, one of the terms that comes up kind of reading about you is the idea of creative expression without approval. And it's kind of it's an interesting term, creative expression without the world's approval, because I think it's a lot of what current movement and the art movement really it likes to express. How did that impact this piece when you were, you know, this is from 1979, 1978.
Yeah.
How did it feed into there as well as your future work?
Yeah. I mean, what they're really referring to is graphic art. Well, actually what they're really referring to is communications design without approval. That is what is unprecedented. So, you know, I trained as a graphic designer because I actually, you know, at the age of 18, wanted to make album covers, because back in the 70s, they were like the principal visual art for my, you know, my generation and my reality. But obviously, graphics is communications design, and communications design is by default for somebody else. Okay, that's what it is. If you are communicating your own opinions and impressions, then that's art or authorship or whatever. But if you are communicating on behalf of somebody else, then that is a commissioned work. And yeah, usually they want to approve it. They want to tell you very clearly what they want to say, and they want to see how you're saying it before they publish it. The extraordinary circumstances around Factory Records was that, you know, a handful of us founded a label because we could, because we wanted to. There was no financial remit. There was like no commercial objective. It was just after punk had happened, the early years of what was called the new wave. And there were some people making music who didn't have record deals, and we thought it would be nice for them to get something on vinyl, and that would help them get a record deal. So we had a kind of a cooperative, and you know, no one was being paid, and effectively nobody was in charge. So it was an opportunity for everybody to do, like, to pursue pop culture the way they felt like it, the way they fantasized about it, the way they believed it should be done. So, you know, the groups went and made the music they wanted to make. In the case of Unknown Pleasures, their producer, Martin Hammett, then produced it the way he wanted to produce it, not the way Joy Division wanted it. You know, but their turn was to play. Martin's turn was to produce. So, you know, he asked them to go away and he produced the album. For the cover, they gave me for Unknown Pleasures, they gave me that. They'd seen Bernard Sumner from the group had seen that CPC 1919 diagram in an encyclopedia of astronomy, and they gave it to me. And then it was just down to me to do what I wanted to do with it. And, I did take it to their manager's house before it went to the printers, and he looked at it and said, looks nice. But nobody approved anything. You know, nobody, there was no, I mean, I was doing it because I wanted to do it. And so, you know, I think everyone felt a little bit uncomfortable about approving each other's work. So I did my bit.
And I see.
It's just that as Factory continued for the next, like, 13 or 14 years, that became the default modus operandi. So I would make covers and groups made records. And yeah, then you would have some, you know.
There's an artist named Dave Krugman right now who sold NFTs a roll of film before he shot them. And now he's going out and he's going to shoot the 10 shots and the NFT is what the person's going to get. It kind of reminds me of that level of, I will, you know, you are the artist and I'm going to sign up for that.
Yes, Sam, the unusual thing is at the beginning when, you know, what we were doing was just going to a few hundred or a few thousand people, it was kind of, you know, it seemed less extraordinary. But by the time with New Order, you get to like Blue Monday and like 2 million people buy Blue Monday. This open access to a mass audience was a quite special and unprecedented opportunity for me. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, every artist does as they wish and it goes somewhere on a wall and maybe like 10 people see it, maybe 10 million see it. But this was work going directly from me to a very big audience. And I'm still astonished to meet people from, I would say, unexpected parts of the world who got to see, I mean, particularly actually Unknown Pleasures. I'm still amazed that somebody will come up to me and say, you know, this meant something to me when I first saw it in, you know, in places I did not expect it to reach and to, you know, people I never thought would be interested.
It brings up one topic and we're running out of time, but it's something that has hit me while we're talking is this idea. One of the concepts in NFTs right now is called CC0. And it's the idea that you put art out there and then the world will do what it will with it. And you kind of give everyone the permission to do that. And you get the derivatives and the tattoos and the different versions. And it seems like before that concept, that was an extremely big part of what this piece has been, where the world has taken that piece and done what it wanted with it and gotten us to a place where it has all the more presence.
Particularly this, particularly this piece, particularly that data map from Unknown Pleasures has really gone out. It's like there's a term palimpsest for blank canvas. It's a thing that people have taken to and interpreted. I think that one of the reasons for that, and one of the reasons it was wonderful for the cover in the first place, is it is totally open to interpretation. You see it and you think it's a heartbeat. You think it's a sound wave. You think it's like some sort of seismograph. I mean, nobody knows that it's the signal from a pulsar. I mean, how would you know that? It is very emotional, though. And when combined with the title Unknown Pleasures, you project onto it. And an interesting thing about it is that as data, it's kind of sci-fi. And so actually it doesn't date, because data doesn't date. A graph is a graph. And as long as it's not kind of like, you know, letterpress with script lettering on it from the Victorian era, as, you know, anything produced in the 20th century as data, it is what it is. It doesn't date. And so this is one of the amazing things about that diagram. It's there with the title, but, you know, the cover has none of that lettering on it. It's just the diagram and it never dates. It looks great on a T-shirt. And it's like, it is relatively timeless.
Peter,
I was blown away when I saw when it was created. But I think we are out of time. But I really, really appreciate
it. I have one quick question, if you guys can hear me.
Oh, geez.
Can you guys hear me? Peter, are you still there?
What I would say, just to conclude, though, is, I mean, while this is timeless, the new iteration that you've created is enchanting. It's beautiful. And I think it shows how this... what was this pulsar idea converts so well into a landscape with that light that it's really beautiful. And everybody, I think you have today is the last day where you can buy that NFT. It's $100.
The edition is closed today and it is extraordinarily beautiful. It's extraordinarily beautiful. And the combination, the image and the sound is like really unique, unique for Steve and I, unique for Peter Saville and Joy Division. It never happened before. And it is actually really beautiful. I love it. I'm really pleased that we did it. I'm pleased that the NFT domain kind of made it possible to do it.
Yeah. No. And thank you very much for the partnership and everything. But I'll turn it back to Kevin.
Yeah. Just one quick question, Peter.
Thanks so much for jumping on.
Peter, if we still have you, can you still hear me here?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. So, Peter, sorry to barge in. One, just want to say again, thank you again, and we're very excited. I'll be collecting this piece, and I know a lot of our listeners will as well. So, thank you for doing it. It's amazing. And the one question I had for you though that I just want to throw out here real quick is, you know, I grew up. I was born in the 70s. I grew up in the kind of 80s and 90s. So for me, this is such an iconic piece that, you know, I will forever remember and still see today all over the place. I think of a few other, you know, similar artworks out there, whether it be the Black Flag logo or, you know, Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon. Are there any other kind of contemporaries or other peers that you...
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple. I mean, you know, you never remember the obvious when you get asked, but I mean, just like a couple. And also because I'm obviously older than you, so I arrived at some of them earlier. The Warhol Banana, you know, on the Velvet Underground album.
Yes.
And that was, that made a big impression upon me because it clarified and brokered the relationship between music and art. Like pop art was something that I did know about as a teenager because it was something I could understand. And, you know, my older brother introduced me to the Velvet Underground and, you know, I didn't really appreciate the Velvet Underground at like 15 or 14, but, you know, but it was entry level for me and it became profoundly important to me. And, but it was the kind of, it was the combination of Andy Warhol and the Velvet Underground that cover evoked actually was, it symbolized to me the concurrency of the disciplines. So I always saw art, music, fashion, photography, to some extent, even architecture and obviously film, all in the same way. You know, I traveled freely between the disciplines and made associations freely between the disciplines. And you know, that the art, music, and lifestyle vibe of the Velvet Underground and Warhol's Factory was like really influential to me.
Yeah.
And then the first album that I actually had to go out and buy for myself because my older brothers, you know, didn't get it, was Kraftwerk's Autobahn. And in the UK, the cover of Autobahn was just the German, you know, freeway symbol, the Autobahn symbol. Mm-hmm. And so it's like a blue background with a white Autobahn symbol on it. And because I knew that Kraftwerk had studied at the Music Conservatory and that their very, very modern music included, acknowledged, recognized like the history of classical music, you know, when I listen to Kraftwerk, I kind of hear like modern and ancient. You know, I hear like the whole canon of the awareness of the entire canon of music. It's quite evident when you listen to Kraftwerk that they know about the canon of classical music that led up to the now. And when I listen to Autobahn, the track, which is, you know, this journey, this drive. I would put on a pair of headphones and close my eyes and I would be like transported across Europe past kind of power stations and cathedrals because the music was an arc between, you know, modern and historic.
Mm.
And so the symbol, the monochromatic, this really simple symbol of the Autobahn, German Autobahn symbol, came to represent for me like an entire like canon of European, actually what David Barry refers to as the European canon.
Hmm.
Okay. So that was for me all contained within this one little simple symbol, which was unwittingly at the age of 18, my introduction to what is referred to as semiotics. You know, I never heard the term semiotics. I didn't even hear the term when I was at art college at that time. When I later came across the term semiotics and understood what it meant, I realized that Autobahn symbol and to some extent the Warhol banana before, they were my intro to semiotics, to the fact that the language, which is, or the all of the information that can be contained within a simple symbol.
Mm. Wow.
I mean, you can't see a Coca-Cola logo without seeing the entire universe of Coca-Cola, you know?
Sure. Sure.
And that was obviously, as somebody going into communications design and art, that was obviously quite an important thing to learn.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
We just
let you know, everyone here on the Proof team and our staff are just absolutely thrilled about this drop, and it's an honor to have you on the show. So
great.
Really appreciate your time.
I think it's been really good to do it. I think it's been really great to do it. So thank you very much.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Sam, I don't know if you're still with us, but thank you for that interview.
It's a great interview.
Yeah. Fantastic job. Yeah,
what an honor to have him on the show. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool.
It's cool to see two data nerds just kind of get into it. Right. That was cool.
Very cool. All right. We have a prompter that is frozen, so I cannot tell you what is coming up next. But I think we're coming to the end of the show. Okay. Mal says it's time to wrap it up. I think we're done for today. But what an awesome show, you guys.
Yeah,
like today was like,
it was a fun one.
It was just a really fun. We got Derek's legs. We got the whole gamut of things
of
today.
Legs. Yeah, legs. No, this was an awesome show. That was one of the best interviews that I've heard in the last 6 months. I mean, his depth of knowledge, his like awareness of what's happening, his own response to making work in light of this new movement, but then also being able to reflect and draw these analogies to having made work over the last 50 years.
Yes.
The whole thing was spectacular.
Yeah.
So it left an imprint for me for sure.
But you're going to mint today then.
I'm definitely jumping on.
Oh, 100%.
And I don't know that much about the drop. It sounds like there's prints for $100, which, I mean, the work is stellar. So I'm definitely going to take a look.
Fantastic. Well, just want to thank everyone for tuning in today. And obviously, special thanks to our special guest that we had on. Such an honor. Hunter Proof is live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific. And then we will have some hats. We'll do it next week. Let's do some hats giveaway. We'll bring them in.
Yes.
We'll call some people out of the chat and do some fun hats. And Sam, of course, awesome job with the interview. And thanks for your insights on the stats side, as per usual. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Bye, everyone.